From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with actress Joan Chen. She was the most popular teenage actress in her native country, China. She returned to China to co-star in Bernardo Bertolucci's epic film, The Last Emperor. Also today, I talk with football player-turned-actor Carl Weathers. He got his big break playing Apollo Creed in the Rocky movies. Now he's using both his athletic and acting abilities in his new film, Action Jackson. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new compact disc recording of the Boston Symphony Orchestra, playing music by Gabriel Fauré. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg examines how talking computers deal with the complexities of human speech. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Joan Chen recently returned to her native China to co-star in Bernardo Bertolucci's film The Last Emperor. The movie is about Pu Yi, who in 1908, at the age of 3, was made emperor of China. A few years later, the dynasty was forced to abdicate the throne, China became a republic, and the young emperor was virtually a prisoner inside the palace, the Forbidden City. In the film, Joan Chen plays the role of Pu Yi's wife. The Last Emperor is the first Western production about modern China that was shot on location in China with the full cooperation of the Chinese government. Joan Chen made her first movie in China when she was 14. She became China's most popular young actress, winning the 100 Flowers Award for Best Actress through a nationwide ballot. Chen came to the United States in 1981 on a student visa. After appearing in an episode of Miami Vice and in the film Dim Sum, she starred in the Dino De Laurentiis epic Taipan. I spoke with Joan Chen from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. I asked her if there was a certain type of role that she played in China when she was making movies as a teenager.
Always was innocent little girl, first time falling in love, always innocent and sweet. I was chubby, a little fat.
And you were chubby?
Yeah, I was chubby. Actually, I was having this big problem of being too heavy when I was a teenager. But my parts are, you know, chubby, lovely girls, so that was fine.
How did you get your first film part?
I was first year in high school, and these people wanted some strong outdoor type person to play a guerrilla fighter, a fighter girl. And they thought I was right for the part. I was in a gun shooting team, and I looked tough and outdoor and dark and strong, you know. I was typecasted for the rest of my Chinese career to be chubby and innocent.
And strong.
Yeah.
So what year are we talking about when you started working in movies?
It was 1976.
Okay.
Yeah. 76. It's been a long time.
Did the government have any control over scripts or content in the movies that you made?
Yeah, over that period of time, yes. Yes, they had to approve everything. Yes. Right now, the studios can have their own rights to approve or disapprove the scripts, but then everything goes to a committee, you know.
So could you tell from the storylines, were they politically correct stories that the movies were made about?
Well, I was young. Anything that was taught to me, I believed in it. I was enthusiastic about me being part of this machine trying to educate people, and I was very proud. Yeah.
Were you expected to be off camera the way you were on camera, that you were also innocent and strong and...
Before, yes. Yes, when I was doing all these films, I came from this family who always taught me a very simple lifestyle, you know, believe in whatever is taught to me. I do believe my teachers and all these things, you know, so I'm very simple and innocent. I was. Yes, I was.
You know, it's interesting. I think in America that even film stars who play very chaste people on camera are expected to be somewhat glamorous. Off camera. Was it that way with you at all?
No, not at all. No, because the value was totally different. We over there, you know, they loved whatever I was. And that's why I formed my image that way, because everybody loved me that way. It was innocent, even off camera, was sweet and innocent and shy, you know. Even if I didn't feel shy, I had this habit of being shy when I meet people, because it was expected. And being glamorous was not the best thing then. You know, they didn't want their actors to look glamorous. That was not attractive to most Chinese eye. You know, it's different.
I think Americans really worship their film stars. Did you feel like you were, you know, almost worshipped by your public in China?
Thinking back and looking back to that period of time, yes, I was. But then I took it for granted, and I thought, well, that's the way life is. You know, people love me. I didn't even think that was the media, that was, you know, the films that I did and everything. And I didn't feel too troubled, but I wasn't extremely thrilled. I just thought that was life, you know. Until I lost it, I said, oh, okay, that was not life.
When did you lose it?
Well, I left.
Oh, I see. When you left, you lost it. I understand. What did you get any special privileges from being a celebrated actress?
Not too much, really. Just all the trips that I made. You know, I was taken care of. Hotels, you know, all everything, and people would offer me all kinds of things. But you know, I didn't get a lot of money like the stars got in here, which I didn't really think of then. You know, I didn't think of money for 19 years of my life. I never thought of what is money, because it was different. But we had the privilege, just like, you know, all the love, fan love you, they want to give you things, people want to take you around to the best places in China and hotels and best food and all these things. More or less, I think it's the same, except, you know, the values are different. So they expect different things out of a star, and they give different things to a star. Yeah.
My guest is actress Joan Chen, and she appears in the film The Last Emperor as the wife of Emperor Puyi. She began her acting career in mainland China, and since coming to the United States, she's also co-starred in the film Taipan. Now, you came to the United States in 1981 on a student visa. Why did you want to leave China? You were so loved and so popular there.
Because I felt extremely empty, because I didn't have enough education. My family, for generations back, are doctors, and they're very keen on education. Basically, Chinese are very keen on education. So I felt I was left very vulnerable, being exposed and everything, but had very little knowledge about life or anything. And also I felt lost, because I was on top of my career when I was a teenager and I didn't know where to go. It seemed like everywhere I would go down. And I was a little scared, not very consciously scared, but just a little restless. And my parents thought it was best if I could go on to have an education. Since I was very young, I felt, why not? You know, I could take a few years off and go to school.
So you came to America. Did you speak English when you first came?
A little bit. Like, this is a cup, and this is a cup of tea, you know, things like that. But not much, no.
Had you seen many American films before you came?
A few old movies, and
which ones?
Everybody in China loved The Sound of Music, and everybody could sing along, and yeah, that part of English I understood, the songs in The Sound of Music. And what I saw, The Red Shoes, do you know?
Oh, sure.
That ballet dancer.
Mm-hmm.
And Waterloo Bridge with Vivien Leigh. I don't know, that was after Gone with the Wind.
Uh-huh.
The movie she did, that one was really loved by everybody.
I haven't even seen it.
Really?
Even seen
because
it, yeah.
The girl there was chaste and innocent and sweet.
Oh,
that's what they, you know, their value is. And yeah, I saw old movies, but I didn't know much about really the contemporary movies at all.
Great. So you came to America, and I'm sure you were very suddenly exposed to a lot of really violent, really sexy movies.
Yeah. I went with friends and students, and some of them are boys, and I always felt, oh, totally embarrassed, you know. I said, no, I don't want to see movies like that. I probably want to see it alone, but not with any other boys. You know, I was very embarrassed. Yeah.
What surprised you about the first American movies that you saw in America?
Just everything was so explicit. I was shocked. I couldn't really enjoy the whole film. I was just in a state of shock. The first movie I saw was Body Heat. I didn't understand a lot of English, though the plot was quite complicated. I couldn't understand much, but I was just thinking, oh no, you know, all these very explicit scenes. And then I rent the tape and saw it again, so wow, it's a great film, you know, I've changed. So
when you came here, did you come here with the intention of becoming an actress in American movies?
No, not at all. No, I was very headstrong in getting a degree and trying to bring things back into China and to serve the country. I was just wanted to go to school.
What made you change your mind?
Basically, the first thing was money, because I wasn't used to paying bills every month. And that gave me extreme pressure, because in China, I never paid any bills. I never wrote a check. I never had to pay any bills. I had my pocket money and spent them, and that was plenty enough for me. But then every month, the housing, the food, and the tuition and everything, that made me feel, God, you know, these green things are important. And so I started working on different things. And finally, people told me the best money if I could do is if I can go act, maybe it's easier. And that's what prompted me first. I said, okay, I'll just do part-time, you know, and while I go to school, maybe I go act a little bit. And that's how I started.
I bet that there weren't that many Asian roles that were open, and most people who are ethnic in any way are cast into ethnic-specific roles, ethnically defined roles.
Yeah, definitely. I was intrigued in the beginning, you know, going on auditions and things, you know, which these things are different from China. And I was very curious. I didn't get a part or didn't get a part. I didn't really care that much. And just started doing these different parts that's totally different from what I did in China. I was very interested. But after a while, I did like 5 Mei Lings. They're all the same in different televisions. Then I said, really got tired of it, you know. Very stereotypical kind of parts.
How did you present yourself when you were first going for auditions? Did you dress a certain way, make yourself up a certain way?
I knew very little about making makeups and you know, how to dress and what people expect me to be. But I just dressed the way I liked myself to be and went in. And certain parts I got, I was surprised thinking back, because many other girls were dressed right and I wasn't dressed right. But I guess I had this raw stuff in me, you know, that thing that's very big. I mean, the kind of passion in me with the film. And that was recognized. And a lot of the times it's not. So I learned. I said, oh, that's not the way they like me to be. They wanted to see me in a different way. So next time I go, I look different. It's a whole process of changing my image. And to find this image was, you know, it's like an education. You know, that, oh, okay, now I know what an Asian girl in this country I expected to look like.
Which is how?
You know, vulnerable, sexy, long black hair, you know, kind of helpless. Most of the parts are like that.
Well, you've just described the absolute opposite of the roles that you used to play in China. In China, you were strong, a little chubby, and you
were innocent.
Innocent, right? And you're talking about sexy and vulnerable. Did you feel kind of silly playing the opposite part of the part that you had been?
in the beginning, I didn't feel silly. I felt very intrigued. I felt, wow, you know, I could do something different. But after a while, it's all the same. So I felt it wasn't right because that was the only image they expected out of Asian women. And also that was the only image they knew. Maybe I should do something. Maybe I could, maybe I couldn't, I don't know. But I thought I should do something to show there are different types of Asian women. And where I came from and where who I am is totally different from the parts they've written for people like me. And I'm still trying. It's difficult. I have nothing to complain. I mean, Hollywood's been actually quite nice to me as a newcomer.
Well, I want to talk more about your acting career, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is actress Joan Chen, and she co-stars in the film The Last Emperor. She plays the last empress, the wife of Pu Yi. She also co-starred in the film Taipan. She grew up in China, where she was one of China's leading young actresses. We'll talk more in a couple of seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Actress Joan Chen is my guest, the co-star of The Last Emperor, directed by Bernardo Bertolucci. Well, your first big film role in America was Taipan, which is, it's a big, you know, Dino De Laurentiis epic. You play a slave girl and mistress to an Australian trader, and you're supposed to be like 14 years old in the beginning of the movie, and you start off, I think, kind of naive and then get more and more the seductress and the manipulative woman as the movie goes on. Did this seem like a stereotype role to you when you took it on?
It's a little, but I didn't mind much because it was 100 years ago, and even in China, women were secondary. And there were a lot of slave girls and mistresses. And also, in the original script, there were a lot more to her than just a slave girl. You know, there were a lot more sides about her as a human being, a woman, than just what we now see on the screen. I really didn't understand why all these were cut out, but, you know, I was extremely happy when I got this part by accident.
Did you study or understudy any American movies to see what kind of image this movie would want to present of the Chinese slave girl and seductress?
No, I read the book, and I felt it could. I've learned a little bit about the Western perspective, and she could be a lovely girl in it because she is smart, and while being sexy and manipulative, she's also innocent. She kept this little innocent and silliness, you know, in her that could be quite lovely. Yet at the same time, she is manipulative, and she tried to talk things into this Taipan's head. To me, it was a very lovely part. And also, she's not contemporary. I saw her as somebody in a distance, you know. I didn't really identify with her that much. It's just a person in a legendary story. I mean, it's supposed to be a glamorous film. It's a legend kind of film. And I loved it when I got the part. No, I didn't think it was any problem. But until the movie was out on the screen, I saw it and I felt many other dimension was out. And she was left to be this slave mistress woman. And it's too simple, kind of symbolic. And it didn't bother me at all when I was working on it.
You are co-starring now in The Last Emperor, directed by Bernardo Bertolucci. How are you cast in the movie? I mean, how did you get the part?
Okay, I was introduced to Bernardo Bertolucci by mutual friend that she's from New York. She's a casting director, and she introduced us. So we met, and we had a nice chat, and basically that was done. And I never auditioned, never had to read out of the scripts or anything. We just had a great chat about the history, about the part, and about China, and me being in America and everything.
Well, the film was shot in China, so you had to go back to your home country to make this movie. It must have been really interesting to get directed by an Italian in a movie about China, set in China, shot on location in China. Because you knew a lot more about China than he did. But he was directing you. Did you have to give him advice about how a Chinese woman would really behave?
Sometimes I do, and he's very good at listening. So that's why this movie is the way it is, because he was very modest and had this very humble and modest attitude when he was in China, really loving and learning this whole culture and everything. And he was great, you know, and he gave me a great
deal. What's some of the advice that you gave him? Did you give him advice on anything?
I would tell him that as an empress or a woman, Wang Yun should be this way or that way. And I studied Wang Yun more than he did, because he studied the whole thing and I studied the part. And he usually listened. And the different versions I could give him, he would have the really sharp and right eye to pick the one that's really the most appropriate.
Are Chinese acting styles different than Western acting styles?
It's a little different, yes.
How is it different?
It's very subtle. It's hard to say, because acting is something it's very hard to explain. Even right now, if I act in Chinese language or I act in English language, my whole presentation would be a little different somehow, would be a little different. Because whatever, we learned Stanislavski in China also, you know, it's not really the Chinese method of acting. It's more or less the same like acting school in here. But the lifestyle and the way we usually, the way of living is different. So it is very different. The gestures that people use in here are not natural to a Chinese, and all the Chinese gestures are not natural to Westerners. So acting is so much part of life that is certainly very different.
Do you feel that in The Last Emperor you acted more in the Chinese style or in the Western style?
I sort of combined both, because if I did the total Chinese way, maybe it wouldn't be as good. As this is in Western angle of the Chinese story. And I think I tried to do everything very Chinese and authentic, but since I was acting in English, I had this Western influence, you know, of there was this very subtle combination I could feel in my acting, and it's very enjoyable, but it's so hard to say when acting is something you really can't explain or something.
No,
you know?
I understand. This was the first major Western feature film shot on location in China, and it was actually even shot in the Forbidden City, in that palace in China. Mm-hmm. And there were many, many, many Chinese extras. I've read in a couple of articles that a lot of the extras were really baffled by how the film was being shot, because they couldn't tell exactly where the cameras were and the crowd scenes. Did you ever have to act as an intermediary between the film crew and the Chinese extras in the movie who were working on it, since you understood Chinese language and the Chinese culture?
Yeah. Intentionally, I was doing it. Unintentionally, I was doing it all the time, because since I was in the middle and was in this position, I could do something, and I was trying to explain all the time. So I was always busy on the set while I was not acting. You know, I was always running around and trying to do something, because I feel for both ends. And I was often constantly explaining things to the people around me if I'm acting, you know, the extras around me or the other Chinese actors who didn't understand English around me. I was trying to explain to them, and sometimes they would ask me to say things to the director, and I would do it. Yeah, it was wonderful, though. It was just great. I felt I could combine whatever I have learned as a Chinese and as somebody who lives now in America. It's great. You know, constantly in China, I would miss America. And in America, I would miss China. And that film was like, you know, we had Western people working on a Chinese film and filming in China, yet at the same time, had a lot of Western influence. It was like a good bridge. And I was very happy during this whole process. It was great.
Now that the Chinese people have had a chance to see you in a couple of other roles, I'm assuming, maybe incorrectly, that the Taipan and the Last Emperor have been shown in China. I don't know if that's really true, but are they aware of your now adult film image? And do you think if you returned to China that you'd be able to break out of the image that you used to have there?
I think so. I think people are ready now. When Taipan first was shot, they were totally surprised that I would take a role like that. And they were hurt. Most of the audience were hurt that they felt it was a degrading part. I mean, slave mistress and to a white man, you know. And they hated me for a while. And also the media and everything just started to write up things about me being corrupted and, you know, being in the West and everything. And after that, I went back to China and talked to a few universities, and I talked on the radios and televisions, tried to explain what I was doing and to explain that it's a totally different world, and people in America didn't feel the part in Taipan was such a degrading woman. I mean, it's a story of a woman 100 years ago, and now they started to understand. And I think when Last Emperor is shown in China, I think it will be in May, people will be very interested in going and see. I think they will love it. And also my image in The Last Emperor was from this innocent girl into a terribly addicted woman. It's a good process of people. They will accept me because there is a process in the film that she is changing. So it's a good film to have the Chinese seen and have them accept me as a totally different person now.
So what are your plans? Do you plan on staying in America or going back to China?
I would love to do my work in both countries. And actually, after Taipan, I did a Hong Kong film. And I am planning to go back to China to do some Chinese films, maybe some films that could be shown in America. Something that's different from other Chinese films because of my knowledge of this country, maybe I could enrich the film there, you know, the films I want to do in China. And that's my biggest ambition. I want to do some Chinese movies and bring it to here. It will be interesting.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure.
My guest has been actress Joan Chen, and she stars as the wife of the Emperor Pu Yi in Bernardo Bertolucci's film The Last Emperor. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Bob Geldof. He was the primary force behind the Live Aid and Band-Aid efforts to raise money for the Ethiopian famine. He's been a member of the Irish rock band the Boomtown Rats and is now recording on his own. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, outrunning taxicabs and smashing bad guys through doors. It's just another day for actor Carl Weathers. The former pro football player co-starred in four Rocky movies and now stars in his own film, Action Jackson. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new compact disc from Seiji Ozawa and the Boston Symphony Orchestra. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg says talking computers have a lot to learn. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson in Washington. Another Palestinian died today of gunshot wounds suffered during a clash with Israeli soldiers. The Israeli military today lifted curfews in the West Bank and Gaza Strip as U.S. Envoy Richard Murphy met with Israeli officials in an effort to find a solution to the violence in the territories. And the PLO announced today that a planned boat trip to Israel by 100 Palestinian deportees would be delayed. No date has been set for the voyage. Israeli officials had said they would turn the boat back if it tried to enter Israeli waters. Italian Prime Minister Giovanni Goria today handed in his resignation, bringing down the country's 47th post-war government. Sylvia Pagioli reports from Rome.
The political crisis had been in the air for the last several days after the government had been repeatedly defeated on several articles of the 1988 budget bill. The defeats occurred when numerous deputies in the five-party governing coalition voted with the opposition in secret ballots. The long delay in passing the budget bill forced the government to call six open confidence votes in order to push through measures to raise revenues. Today, the government was once again defeated on two appropriation bills. Goria had been in office since last July, and although his government's lifespan was not the shortest in post-war Italy, it was one of the most tormented. In announcing his decision to resign before Parliament this afternoon, the Prime Minister accused the MPs of irresponsibility and said that the government could not fulfill its mandate because of the lack of cohesion in the coalition. For National Public Radio, this is Sylvia Poggioli in Rome.
South African officials say they've put down a military coup in the tribal homeland of Bophuthatswana. South African troops entered the homeland to rescue ousted government officials. Two people died in the coup. The South African Foreign Ministry says it continues to recognize the government of Lucas Mangope. Bophuthatswana is located inside South Africa, about 200 miles northwest of Johannesburg. Only South Africa recognizes its independence. The army accused Mangope of corruption and human rights abuses. The military said it had planned to turn over power to the homeland's opposition party. The Army's ban on the reenlistment of homosexuals was ruled unconstitutional today by a federal appeals court. In a case from Seattle, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the Army unlawfully denied reenlistment to a soldier who had admitted on his original enlistment application that he had homosexual tendencies. The court said the Army's action denied the soldier equal protection under the law. The British government has suffered another setback in its efforts to ban publication of Spycatcher, the book by former secret agent Henry Wright. Today, Britain's Court of Appeals turned down the government's request for a permanent injunction. NPR's Bill Buesenberg has more from London.
Spycatcher is published freely outside Great Britain. It's been on the New York Times bestseller list for 28 weeks, but it still can't be published inside Britain, where it's technically banned. The government is slowly losing its battle against the book, however. After today's appeals court ruling, the British government now has only one more chance, a last resort appeal to the House of Lords, acting as the equivalent of the U.S. Supreme Court. The government wants the book banned for national security reasons and because its author violated a vow of secrecy. Spycatcher describes a British Secret Service plot to undermine Harold Wilson's Labour government in the 1970s. Today, editors called the appeals court ruling in their favor an important triumph. Andrew Neil is editor of the Sunday Times.
I think it's a famous victory for the freedom of the press. On the two occasions now when this case has been tried in full court, the government has lost the case. And I'm heartened by that. The only thing that depresses me is that the government still feels it necessary to continue with this legal charade and go on to the House of Lords.
I'm Bill Duesenberg in London.
Two senators said today they believe a former Panamanian official when he says the CIA routinely sent Panamanian military leader General Manuel Noriega classified reports on U.S. lawmakers. The CIA denied the reports were sent.
This is Fresh Air. Conductor Seiji Ozawa is celebrating his 15th year as music director of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz lives in Boston, but he's not an Ozawa fan. Lloyd says Ozawa's recordings are even emptier than his live performances, but on his new recording of Foray, orchestral music, there's something special that even Lloyd admires.
Seiji Ozawa has a reputation as a technician, as a conductor who can keep the orchestra from falling apart even in the most difficult pieces. Audiences are impressed by the way he conducts every score from memory. In Preston Sturges's classic movie, Unfaithfully Yours, a reporter wants to know why conductor Rex Harrison uses a score. "Because I can actually read music," he replies. Of course, Ozawa can read music. But his memorized performances tend to gloss over details. He favors a coarse blending of sound instead of encouraging individual voices and colors. The orchestra plays soft and loud, especially loud, but with very little dynamic variety in between. For such an athlete, practically a ballet dancer on the podium, Ozawa has surprisingly little rhythmic flair. His phrasing is square, unimaginative, even plodding, without style or the conviction that music means anything. Every composer comes out sounding the same. Lately, though, there seems to be cause for mild optimism. People are talking about the new Seiji. He's not so cute anymore. He's given up wearing beads. He's getting older, and he seems more serious and thoughtful. He's still better at big climaxes than at what leads up to them, but in music that relies more on tunes than on architecture, Ravel rather than Beethoven, he can make a passable, if not memorable, impression. As on his latest CD, an album of some very pretty music composed by Gabriel Fauré, though for the most part orchestrated by others. In 1898, Fauré wrote some incidental music for an English production of Maeterlinck's play Pelléas and Mélisande. Later, he turned some of this music into an orchestral suite. This new CD also includes a song that Fauré didn't use in his suite, a haunting ballad in English that Mélisande sings at the window as she's combing her hair. It's about three blind sisters waiting to be rescued from their prison tower. I first heard this song at a BSO concert a little over a year ago. It was sung at short notice by a remarkable young soprano with a sumptuous voice, Lorraine Hunt, who has done impressive work in a couple of Peter Sellers opera productions and in the world premiere of John Harbison's The Flight into Egypt, last year's Pulitzer Prize winner. Ozawa's smartest musical decision was keeping her for the recording.
Thank you.
The CD also includes a well-played but droopy, unatmospheric performance of the famous Pavane in Fauré's choral version, with pastoral verses written by the Comte Robert de Montesquieu, who was the model for Proust's Baron de Charlus. There's also the Elegy with BSO cellist Jules Eskin, and the syrupy Dolly Suite, which is much livelier in Fauré's own original piano forehand version. Here it's French perfume with no smell. If this album is remembered for anything, it will be as the recording debut of Lorraine Hunt.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He reviewed a new Deutsche Grammophon CD of Seiji Ozawa with the Boston Symphony Orchestra featuring Lorraine Hunt. This is Fresh Air.
Without a ranked contender, what this fight is going to need is a novelty. This is the land of opportunity, right? So Apollo Creed on January 1st gives a local underdog fighter an opportunity. A snow white underdog, and I'm going to put his face on this poster with me. And I'll tell you why. Because I'm sentimental. And a lot of other people in this country are just as sentimental, and there's nothing they'd like better than to see Apollo Creed give a local Philadelphia boy a shot at the greatest title in the world on this country's biggest birthday.
That challenge not only launched the career of Rocky Balboa, but it established actor Carl Weathers, who played reigning champion Apollo Creed. After three more Rocky films, several supporting roles, and a TV series, Carl Weathers has won the title role in the new film Action Jackson. Before he broke into acting, he played football for the Oakland Raiders. In Action Jackson, Weathers is a cop who's demoted to a desk job for unorthodox behavior, but he doesn't let his sedentary position keep him from the action. Action Jackson was written for Weathers, who worked closely with the producer. In fact, Weathers came up with the character's name.
Actually, I was talking to an Australian one day, and he was telling me about this incredible love affair that he was in, and then he made mention of a phrase, Action Jackson, and I said, hey, sounds like a good movie to me, sounds like a guy I'd like to know. And then I had this last name, Jackson, and I was looking for a first name, and I thought, well, you know, he's a strong guy, and he's very physical, and you think of something happening, and I think of Jericho, the walls came tumbling down. And so that's pretty much how it came about.
Now, you're a very muscular guy, but you're more of an athlete than, say, well, I don't know if you bodybuild or not, but your background is an athlete as opposed to martial arts,
yes,
for instance.
Yes.
So in writing the stunts, were the stunts written for someone from your kind of athletic background?
Yes. When I do movies and develop movies now, I certainly look, when I'm the star of the movie or I'm involved in the movie in a lot of the stunts, to build stunts that I can do very well, and then, you know, the kind of stuff that's more like track and field and that comes out of football, which is the world I came out of, as opposed to bodybuilding and martial arts and that kind of thing, you know?
Well, really the very first stunt that you do is running. There's a scene where you're kind of attacked by a taxi cab.
I like that. And I love the way you put that.
and you say, I've got to go and catch a cab.
Yes.
And you start chasing the cab, and in the movie you're running at the same speed that the cab is going.
I ultimately chase it and catch it and then surpass it and jump on top of it. It's a Carl Weathers kind of day, you know what I mean? Kind of stuff I do in a normal day in Los Angeles.
Well, just the running. Just seeing you run, I thought, well, that's the first stunt.
Yes, that was 12 hours that day of just running. It's the toughest day I've ever had in filmmaking.
Was that part of the goal, to get to see you run? I mean, were you a very good runner when you were a football player?
It wasn't so much that. I think since I did some of the Rockies, though, and particularly the scene that we're running on the beach, a lot of the kind of male, and particularly women love to see this body and this flesh moving around. Isn't it terrible? I mean, you think of this dainty, wonderful group of human beings, this group of humanity who wants to see this man's body running down the beach or running on a sidewalk or running down the street. So I said, come on. I make movies for people. I make movies for people who like movies and who want to go see movies. Give them what they want. run, Carl, run. See, Carl, run. Carl can run fast.
Okay, so we got this scene where you're running at the same speed that the taxi cab is being driven. Special effects there?
No, it was real. That was all very real.
Was anything done to make it seem like he was driving faster than he was really driving?
No, I mean, you really don't have to do very much, you know, when you're, I mean, if you've got a human body and it's running the speed of a taxi cab, my goodness, there's not a lot to do. We didn't do anything mechanically to the film to speed it up, if that's what you mean. That wasn't done. You don't have to make things look fast. It's going pretty fast as it is, you know?
Another real athletic moment for you. There's a huge, big guy guarding.
He's huge and big. Yes, he is, all in one.
He's guarding the door. He's unbudgeable. Yes. You punch him in the face. You punch him in the chest. All it does is hurt your knuckles.
Yes.
And then you basically ram him as if you were doing a tackle
through
in a football move, and you ram him right through the doorway.
Yeah.
And that struck me as a real football kind of
what do you
maneuver.
Want from me? That's where I come from, you know? It's kind of like
so was that written for you? Like, let's give him a real football kind of thing to
do? Well, it wasn't. I don't think it was specified as football, but, you know, men are strange animals. It's kind of like an elephant. You know, you run at it, you knock it down, you mow it down, and then you get up and say, hey, I did it. And that's pretty much the way that whole thing was designed. We had to show you different aspects of Jackson and also do it with tongue-in-cheek and a sense of humor.
May I help you?
Yeah, I'd like to speak to Miss Ash.
I don't recommend that course of action.
I do.
You're one big fella. How much do you weigh?
270 pounds.
Well, that's pretty big. I bet you make a good living at this, don't you?
Good enough. That helps pay my way through medical school.
If I was to hit you again, you'd probably slam my little body right through that wall back there now, wouldn't you?
I was thinking about it, but it goes against all my Muslim beliefs.
Ah. Good.
Let me do one of your lines. Your police captain calls you in and says, Jackson, you tore that kid's arm off, and you say,
so he had a spare.
Right.
I love that.
I love that line.
Yes. A lot of people have liked that line. That's one of the, for me, that's one of the best lines in the whole movie, you know. And Bill Duke, the guy who plays my captain, is he was in Predator also, so we've worked together before. He's a good friend, and he's a wonderful director besides.
Now, you got started as an athlete, football player. Mm. Were you interested in acting when you were playing football?
Well, in actuality, it really, I got started as an actor when I was in fifth or sixth grade. It's the first play that I ever did. And I went through years of junior high school and high school, and finally into college when I got a scholarship as a football player at San Diego State U. I majored in theater, you know, drama, and got a degree in dramatic arts. And I was just very fortunate that I got a chance to do both things at one particular point in my life. I was a football player and essentially earning my living that way and having a lot of fun doing that. And at another point, you know, I get to do what I've always wanted to do since I was a kid, which was be a professional actor.
I think people first really noticed you in your role as Apollo Creed in Rocky. Yeah. And how were you cast in that? Did you know much about boxing?
I knew nothing about boxing. I had never boxed. I'd never had gloves on. I'd never been in the ring. I'd never been to a boxing match. And I knew about the script. I mean, there was this wonderful script circulating, and the producers and the director, John Avildsen, apparently had seen just about everybody in the country. So at this particular point, you know, they were, I guess, at a loss for someone to play this role, and I, at the same time, wanted desperately to get into interview for this role. Finally, they got me in to read, and I went in. It was very late one afternoon, about 6:30. And I went in, and they introduced me to the director, and I met Bob and Irwin, the producers. And finally, they introduced me to call the man in, and he was the writer. And they introduced me to him, and I said, how you doing, and all that sort of stuff. And he sat down at a desk, and I read with the writer. And the writer was reading, and I was reading, and the writer was reading, and I was reading. And he didn't get very excited about the reading. So finally, at the end of it all, when everyone was very quiet in the room, and they were sort of looking at each other and maybe mumbling to each other, and I'm very nervous that maybe I've blown the interview, you know, because it's very important. You want to get it. You're just anxious. And I turned to them and just blurted out, you know, if you get me a real actor, I could do a much better job. Well, I didn't know that the writer and the star of the movie were one and the same. They didn't say, this is Sylvester Stallone, he's going to star in the movie. Right, you laugh. That's the way I felt. I felt like an idiot. I felt like a moron after I realized this guy was starring in the movie also. But needless to say, apparently ignorance truly is bliss. I got the role ultimately.
You get a knockout punch in Rocky IV that kills the character.
Yes,
Apollo
kills
Creed
him off.
Is dead
gone.
In the ring. Did you want to be written out of the series?
No. Are you kidding? No. I mean, not in a million years would I have wanted to be written out. But once it was done, you know, as much as I resisted in the beginning, I realized that there was a great opportunity because, first of all, the character is immortalized in the ring, you know, in the movie. And then by that character dying, finally, you know, Carl Weathers has a chance to go on and live in other roles because once the character is dead, then it's very obvious that Carl Weathers is an actor. And, you know, if you've got to die, what a wonderful afterlife.
You've started your own production company, Stormy Weathers, mm-hmm. it's called. Are you producing things to give you roles? Is that part of the
primarily, it's a way of survival, a means of survival. And now, as a result of what I've learned and how much I've matured in the business and how much I love the business, there'll come a point where, and already has come a point where I want to produce things for other people that I don't want to necessarily be in everything that I produce. I don't necessarily want to star in everything that I produce. There's some things I'd also like to direct and not produce or star in, you know. So there are a lot of facets that are still there to explore.
Carl Weathers, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Carl Weathers stars in the new film, Action Jackson. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel and see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
So what stories are you covering?
Well, we're following the Middle East, U.S. diplomatic efforts. They're trying to get a Middle East peace conference off the ground. Also, news of the coup in the South African homeland, Maputo-Tswana, a coup that was crushed by South African troops that have restored the ousted leader of that country, which the South Africans claim is independent, put him back into power. And also we have a piece about a practice for people who love their pets who have died and people who can't reconcile themselves to taxidermy. They freeze-dry them.
Huh. Well, thank you, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Talking computers are no longer confined to the realms of science fiction and fantasy. Language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg has these thoughts on this new technology.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
When the movie 2001 first came out, a lot of reviewers were quick to point out that the computer Hal was the only human character in the movie. What made Hal work, of course, was that uncanny voice of his. Not the voice of a machine, but the voice of a man who thought he was a machine, who imagined himself to be wholly rational and infallible. It was the voice of a madman, in short, and it articulated all our worst fears about what kinds of people computers might become. The talking computers are among us now, but we can rest assured they sound comfortingly like machines. I've been fooling around lately with a little program called Smooth Talker that's made by a Southern California outfit called First Byte. Smooth Talker performs what's called text-to-speech synthesis on a home computer like a Macintosh. You enter some written text, and the program reads it back to you. The system doesn't use any pre-recorded sound. It actually builds up the voice digitally. Here's what it sounds like.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Okay, it's clear that this system is not about to put Alistair Cook out of a job. Right now, these simple text-to-speech systems are being applied to much more mundane tasks. For example, they make computers accessible to the blind. And they have the potential to revolutionize the teaching of writing and reading once a student can enter a text and hear it read back immediately.
How I spent my summer vacation. Billy and me went fishing. I caught a trout, but it got away.
Systems like these are instructive for two reasons. It's impressive to see what they can do, and instructive to learn what they can't. Their accomplishments are considerable. For example, Smooth Talker does a pretty good job with the notoriously difficult problems of English spelling. Listen to it read the sentence, "The heart of the bear is near the earth."
The heart of the bear is near the earth.
That's not bad when you consider that the letters E-A-R have four different pronunciations in the four words heart, bear, near, and earth. Then, too, the program is capable of changing its intonation. The trouble is that it doesn't know when to use one intonation or another because it doesn't understand what it's saying. Let's say you've got a story where a little boy comes home and asks his mother what's for dinner. What you want the machine to say is something like this.
What are we having for dinner, mother?
But suppose the same sentence pops up in a story about two cannibals who are wondering who their next meal will be. Now you want the program to read it differently, like this.
What are we having for dinner, mother?
Of course, the program can only make this distinction if it has outside prompting. But then, why should we expect a computer to understand what it reads any better than a typical TV newscaster does? Of course, the real problem with systems like this one is the voice itself. They sound, well, they sound inhuman. On the other hand, I'm not sure that we want a computer to sound too lifelike. It's not troubling to see a computer putting written words onto the screen. Writing is impersonal and quite literally disembodied. It requires only a mind somewhere. But the human voice is intimately connected to its physical circumstances. You can tell from somebody's voice if they're tired or hungry or in pain, even if the sensation has nothing physically to do with the vocal cords. That's why computers can never have authentic human voices, because they can't know what it's like to live in the soft, damp speaker housings that we walk around in all day. So maybe it's a good idea to keep them sounding a little mechanical. It will help to remind us that when they act up, they're not really feeling cranky or excitable, or even paranoid like Hal. They're just suffering from hyperactivity in their little silicon glands.
Here's what's coming up on tomorrow's Fresh Air. Tomorrow, rock critic Ken Tucker will review the new album from Rick Astley. His song Never Gonna Give You Up is a hit in England, and it's now getting a lot of airplay here in the United States. Also tomorrow, we'll satisfy your curiosity about what Ken Tucker was like before he became a rock critic. It's the latest in our series of interviews with Fresh Air's contributors. And finally, film critic Stephen Schiff will review The Unbearable Lightness of Being, starring Daniel Day-Lewis. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.